Welcome to Whitley on Wine. My guest today is Rupert Symington of the Symington Port Family, Premium Port Wines. And today I think we're going to talk a little bit about the history of the Symington family in the port business. Rupert, approximately how long has your family been in the port business?
Well, my great-grandfather arrived as a young man of just 18 in 1882. And I think he was about 3 years working in other businesses. Until he decided.
No, was he just a sun seeker, leaving the UK to find some sunshine?
He came from Scotland. His father had been a very wealthy bank trustee, but the bank had failed, and he was ruined. So his children were scattered about the globe trying to seek their fortunes. And because of the family's connections with the textile trade, he went to work in Oporto for the Graham's textile business.
Well, you know, if you go to Portugal and you look at the port, you'll see all of these British names. Where were you in the chain of events that took all those Brits down to Porto?
We recently arrived 125 years ago, but my great-grandmother, who my great-grandfather married shortly after arriving in Oporto, she came from a family dating back to 1680 when her ancestor had been the British consul in Oporto in the late 1600s, which was really at the beginning of the whole port trade.
You know, port is a worldwide endeavor now. It's consumed in, you know, every corner of the globe you could possibly imagine. But back then, I would imagine it was fairly regional.
It was. And back then, I mean, Britain was by far the biggest consumer of wine in the world. Back then in the 1650s, when a lot of people were still living in thatched, you know, stone cottages without heating and glass in the windows, there were these feudal lords living in their castles and consuming, you know, several bottles a day of Burgundy and Bordeaux. There's a great book called Knee Deep in Claret, which traces the early origins of Bordeaux drinking in Britain. But I think it was this insatiable demand for wine that drove these British merchants down to find pastures new. Britain was always at war with France, and when the government slapped a very high tax on French wines, merchants went down to Spain and Portugal to try and find other wines that were cheaper, and that's how port really started at the very beginning.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of port production is the fact that the vineyards are so far removed from where the wines are aged, and how did all of that evolve? And could you tell our listeners a little bit about the geography and the lay of the land and where the quintas are and how it relates to Porto and Vila Nova de Gaia and whatnot.
Well, the first ports, the first wines called Port, which was named after the city of Porto, were actually wines from the coast where the rainfall is quite high. But as tastes develop, merchants pushed further upstream. They found a range of mountains about 40 miles to the east of the city of Oporto. And they went over those mountains, and behind them they found these monks growing fantastically, you know, these vineyards with fantastically deep, red, rich wines. The merchants started buying these wines, and they constructed these flat-bottomed boats that would then float the wines down this fast-flowing River Douro down to the coast. One of the reasons that the city of Oporto evolved as the home of port rather than the vineyard area is that this is where the merchants stored their wines prior to being embarked on sailing vessels to take them up to Britain. And today we have these big warehouses in the city of Vila Nova de Gaia, across the banks, across the river from Porto. And fortunately today we don't have to put all the wines on boats anymore. But as the fame of these Upper Douro wines spread, so did the fame of the wine and the region. And the region was planted over about 150 years, going all the way up almost to the Spanish border. The region itself is protected from the coastal rain by a range of mountains that go up to about 3,000 feet. And this keeps a lot of that sort of coastal drizzle. And then if you go over the mountains going east towards the Spanish border, the rainfall falls off very sharply. And you have somewhere up there, I mean, a semi-desert. It's a bit like the Central Valley of California. You've got a coastal range, and then you've got this interior region of vineyard. Although our vineyard's very, very steep.
It's quite beautiful, by the way.
Yeah. It's beautiful, and it's
stunning, actually.
We don't get a lot of rain during the summer months. We get a little bit of rain in the winter. And the vines really have to survive the summer without any natural rainfall. So they put their roots very deep to find water, and they do produce this incredibly rich and intense red wine.
What was the Symington family's first port house?
My great-grandfather became a partner with someone called Reginald Qualls Harris, known as Cousin Reggie, who, poor chap, was so poor that on every Sunday he would come to lunch with the Symington family, and he would eat everything on his plate. He was so hungry. So every generation of the Symington family has been learnt to leave. When you eat everything on your plate, it's called a Cousin Reggie plate. So it's a very important bit of family history there. Qualls Harris was a smaller shipper. It had been quite a big shipper that had been destroyed by the phylloxera that came through northern Portugal in about 1875. And my grandfather, great-grandfather, went on to become partners with the Waugh family, who were the owners of Waughsport and Dow's. And in about 1905, he actually took over the running of the and ownership of the Waugh business. The Waugh family went back to England.
And was Dow's included?
Dow's was partially included, and then by the 50s, we'd bought out the Waughs completely from the Dow business as well. So they were separate companies, but they were both had Waugh shareholders.
But now you have, your empire is much larger than that. You have Graham's.
In 1970, my father's generation bought Graham's in 1970, along with the company Smith Woodhouse. Each generation has added something, and my generation bought Quinta de Vesuvio and Quinta de Rorige, which are two great estates. So we've really gone from being négociants. You know, I think my great-grandfather and my grandfather's generation were largely buying made wines from farmers. My father's generation became winemakers. We started to buy grapes and vinify them ourselves in our own wineries. And my generation, we've moved a bit further downstream, and we're now growers to a much greater extent than my great-grandfather.
What was it like growing up in the business? Was that preordained? Were you always destined to run the Symington family business?
My great-grandfather set up a very interesting business model, a succession model. He said, well, look, I've got three sons. They're each going to take a third of the business. And their three sons had the right to take over a third of the business. So I'm now the fourth generation. In fact, I don't work with any brothers. I work with cousins. We have three branches of the family still, and we run it like a triumvirate. So there's three of us running the company, and we're each the direct descendant of Andrew James Symington's sons, which is, it makes for a very nice, good balance of power in the company.
And did you get involved in all aspects of the business as you were growing up? I mean, did you tread grapes and do all that sort of...
It's very hard to grow up in the Symington family without being involved in all aspects of the business. I mean, our business is, it's a family business. This is all we do. And we obviously spent a lot of time growing up, you know, accompanying the harvest, taking customers to the Douro. So we grew up, I grew up running around the Douro like a, you know, a wild thing. And I count myself as one of the lucky few who knows the Douro very well. And I think every member of the family has a huge respect and a love for the Douro. Nowadays, it's much more about, you know, with more vineyard ownership, we have much more social responsibility in the region. We're now employing more people in the Douro than we do down in the coast in Vila Nova de Gaia. So we do feel very attached to the region. We all own vineyards personally as well as through the company. And we're very sort of hands-on in our vineyards as well. But I felt, you know, I never had any pressure to join the business, but I kind of felt that I'd be stupid not to, really.
Sure. Now, you have a very strong presence here in the United States. The Symington port houses do, the brands do. When did that start? Has that always been the case? Did you inherit that, or is that something that your generation pursued?
I think I have to hand it to my father, James Symington, too. He was responsible for the family for all the far-flung markets, he called it. He saw back in the 60s and the 70s the potential of the U.S. The U.S. was starting to be it went away from being just a sort of, you know, a few collectors. There was a new growing interest in wine at all levels of society. And that was really the birth of the Napa Valley at the same time. Mm-hmm. The interest, I mean, obviously had been wineries there, you know, 50, 100 years before. But I think the real interest in California wine started, you know, beginning of late 70s, beginning of the 80s. And my father really believed that the U.S. had potential. So he came here. He spent a lot of time traveling around, meeting wine merchants, talking up port. And I really have to hand it to him. Today, my family are responsible for about one bottle in three of all premium ports consumed worldwide. But the U.S. remains far and away the biggest, the most premium market that we have.
What do you think people are most interested in? Your kind of holy grail, the vintage ports, or your aged tawnies, which are, you know, beautiful in their own way?
But I think vintage ports remain the sort of the factor that you know provides the most excitement. I mean, these are wines that are only produced three or four times a decade, and only in great years. But I think what people have got used to on an everyday basis is tawny port. I mean, that's become, if you like, as vintage has become rarer and more expensive, people have fallen in love with things like Graham's 20-year-old tawny, which is just a fantastically seductive everyday wine, or even Graham's Six Grapes, which is a young, vibrant, fruity wine.
It's a beautiful wine, yes.
I think port fits the American taste profile, even though it's fashionable to say that you don't like sweet wine. I think everyone loves something with, you know, lots of flavor and lots of fruit. And I think we fit that bill perfectly with port.
You know, we were talking about the foods that you like to have with port. And we happen to have some dessert, but we both sort of gravitated the conversation toward cheese, because that's my favorite food to have with port.
Well, I totally agree there. I'm just a cheese nut. I think the tawnies go really well with those good, smelly, runny, you know, Camembert family of cheeses. And I think the premium rubies, like Six Grapes.
Like, or blue cheeses.
Or, yeah, Dow's LBB, that goes great with a Stilton. I think Danish Blue is a little too sharp, but just Stilton, Red Leicester, that family of cheese. And then vintage port with an aged Cantal, something with a little saltiness to it. I think that's just a marriage made in heaven as well.
Terrific. It's always good to end on a note where you're talking about a fabulous wine and food pairing. Thank you, Rupert Symington.
Thank you, Robert.